Welcome, everybody. Tonight we have what we call a forum at Holden Village, which is an hour or so to discuss a really controversial topic in a differing and respectful way. Monday night, and probably many of you were here when we had this forum on peace, and we obviously had various perspectives represented, and we certainly have that here tonight as well. So I'll just sort of serve as a kind of moderator and introduce the question, and also our panelists tonight who are on the teaching staff. Let me just say, I first heard about Namibia in 1977 when I was a Waitrose staff here, and Mary Schramm was up here leading stuff on Namibia, and we all said, what's Namibia? And she explained this was a country occupied by South Africa that was something like 95% Lutheran, and she thought that we at Holden should be working for independence for Namibia. And that started something really important, I think, for Holden, in that many people did become quite involved in advocacy. My hunch is that there's probably some of you here who have heard for the first time during this week through the teaching that Michael and Susan Thomas have done, and also Joe Bach and Sue Like, that there even is such a thing as a Palestinian Lutheran, Arab, Christian. I admit, when I first heard that, I thought it was an oxymoron. I had no idea what it was about. But now, now I'm really happy to be able to say that at our seminary in Chicago, there are two Palestinian, Lutheran, Arab students studying for the ordained ministry. And so I've really had my eyes open on this whole issue. And perhaps that's happening for you as well. And so I wanted to frame the question tonight in a somewhat controversial way that hopefully will generate a lot of varying opinions. Palestinian Christians and Muslims make the argument that Israeli military occupation of the West Bank and Gaza is similar to apartheid in South Africa. Do you agree? What should our response be as U.S. Christians? So we'll hear, I'll throw in a few comments later on. I can give some of the history about what the Lutheran Church did on the apartheid issue, for example, because it became a theological issue where we felt that black South Africans were denied access to aspects of the gospel, that it became a status confessionis issue, almost of confessional importance for us. And we can talk about this issue theologically as well as all the political, social, economic, and other aspects of it. So to open our discussion tonight are Michael Thomas, who's a pastor at Lutheran Church of the Redeemer in Jerusalem, Sue Like, who just recently returned from 3 years in Jerusalem, Joe Bach, married to Sue Like, who just returned from 3 years in Jerusalem and was director of the Catholic Relief Agency there, and Susan Thomas, who's also a pastor at Lutheran Church of the Redeemer in Jerusalem, and she was there the most recently. She just left on July 4th, right? So if they all fall asleep, you know they're on jet lag. So who's starting? Michael, are you starting?
No,
Joe.
Okay,
great. They'll make brief remarks, and then we open it up to all of you.
One of the points that I wanted to make before we get started tonight is that I know that this is a controversial topic. All of us realize that it is. We assume that most of you, if not all of you, have been exposed to what is commonly portrayed in the media in the United States regarding the horrendous nature of the suicide bombing and that sort of thing. And to a large extent, we're assuming that you know about that. What is difficult for those of us who have lived in Jerusalem and seen what's going on there on a day-to-day basis is that the other side of that story tends not to get told in this country. And that is to say, the Palestinian story, their side of it. And so as a matter of education, to try to balance that out, we feel compelled to make sure that that side of the story is also understood. It doesn't mean that we don't empathize with the Israeli families who have experienced their loved ones die in this human tragedy between people of differing faiths at all. What we're concerned about is making sure that there is an understanding also of the Palestinian perspective. And I think, to be very candid with you, I think that, you know, there is a strong feeling that there is, as Susan was saying earlier tonight, there is a substantial power imbalance in the sense that the Israelis are the occupiers, the Palestinians are the occupied. The Israelis have the overwhelming amount of military might vis-a-vis the Palestinians. And the behavior of the Israelis relative to the Palestinians is that of occupiers, and it often seems to us to be rather excessive, and it is our government that, in a sense, enables that excessiveness. And therefore, we feel compelled to point that out as people who have lived there and have seen this. What I would like to comment on as it relates to the topic of tonight is that I do think that there is a similarity between the situation of apartheid in South Africa and what currently exists in Israel and the Palestinian territories. There is an oppressed minority, that is to say the Palestinian people, who are being confined to what amounts to Bantustans. It differs somewhat in the sense that the Bantustans in South Africa had territorial integrity, whereas the settlements have divided these two Bantustans up by virtue of their illegal, under international law, settlements throughout the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip. The differences are that the white South Africans had not, as far as I know, and I'm no expert on South Africa, so please correct me if I'm wrong, but as far as I know, the white South Africans did not experience the type of discrimination and slaughter that the Jewish people did for centuries, not just the genocide during World War II. It is also different in that there is more racial ambiguity. You can walk down a street in Jerusalem and see some people that are Jewish who are look at the same race as Palestinians. So there is racial ambiguity. Third, the religious dimension was not as a convoluting of a factor in South Africa. The Jewish claim on the Promised Land, to which a lot of Orthodox Jews in particular feel gives them the right to push the Palestinians off of that land, is a much more complicated religious factor that makes it a much more difficult and convoluted conflict to deal with. It is also a place where monotheism began, and therefore the roots of monotheism, where people feel that they have a kinship with the Jewish people. So I think that there are some fairly major differences. From the standpoint of, is the strategy that the world used to try to force the white South Africans to change their behavior relative to the blacks in South Africa, is that same strategy something that can be employed here? I would say no. And I'm sorry to say that, but based on what I have analyzed here, let me give you the reasons. Number one, we have a problem of some greedy spoilers on both sides. We have power-hungry people who are attempting to spoil any chance at peace, substantial progress that was made. There are people who have something to gain by the violence, and they are the spoilers of this situation. On both sides, both in Palestine and in Israel. Number two, the role of collective guilt following the Holocaust makes it very difficult for the world to deal with this problem, and it convolutes it time and time again. Number three, the current Israeli and Palestinian leadership, I don't see that they have the capacity to pull this off. There were South African white leaders as well as South African black leaders who were impeccable in many respects in taking risks and being real leaders. We don't have those people right now. Yes, it would be possible to hit the pocketbook of the Israelis through economic embargoes, but to a very large extent, let's be honest, this conflict has already hit their pocketbooks. So no, this is not, in my opinion, a viable option.
Thank you. Next, Sue, are you, who's next?
Did you want questions?
No, we're doing this, I think we're doing the whole
panel. Yeah, doing the whole panel first, and then we'll open it up, if that's okay.
Well, I can just share some impressionistic thoughts. I went there as a spouse. I went there and I was homeschooling my kids while we were there. And I'm also a very curious person. I went out and about in as many corners as I could with our kids and alone. But we did live in a Palestinian neighborhood, so my frame of reference was really more over there than the Israeli side. And I guess I have three perspectives. I think a large number of Palestinians and Israelis do desire some sort of peaceable coexistence, whether it's two states or one state differs within that. Most people see it as a two-state. And the way in which I see that is the way in which people interacted on a daily level. Many people, shopkeepers, Palestinian shopkeepers trading with Israelis, and to a much lesser degree, vice versa. Students from Hebrew University that Joe taught making their very first foray into a Palestinian neighborhood to come to our house one night for dinner. Very nervous, but very willing to walk into that neighborhood. So I see lots of signs of people willing to coexist. And the Palestinians, I think most of them by and large feel like they have no choice, but they're used to doing that. Many of their jobs are dependent on the state of Israel, and so that coexistence is natural and just happens. There are communities like Neve Shalom, which are a very intentional village. It's a very intentional village or city that has a mixed Palestinian and Israeli population with very strict guidelines and applications to join and criteria and scrutiny in order to make this work. There are schools which have Palestinian and Israeli kids. So there's that will there. And I suspect that is the overwhelming majority. There's another large portion of people that are that believe in it, but think it's a utopia to think that they can coexist. Most Israelis that we met non-professionally were very, very, very afraid of the Palestinians. They couldn't believe where we lived. They couldn't believe we drove around in cars without bulletproof windows. They would make statements, I would never go there, I have never been there, and it was just a mile or two from where they were. Very, very afraid to go there. On the other hand, again, the Palestinians are forced, they are the ones that have to interact with Israel, so that same fear in a way wasn't there, except more of soldiers and police and settlers. That was a different sort of fear. But I think many Israelis would like to make it work, but are distrusting of whether that would work. And the other thing that we certainly saw were the amount of fences erected, both in traditional Israeli neighborhoods as well as the settlements. People were locked in and, walled in, very, very, very afraid. They lived that way, and that certainly affects your perspective of how you live. But it was an us and them, kind of an apartheid sort of thinking and mentality and vision. And then there's also a certain amount of people on both sides, both Israelis and Palestinians, that certainly have no vision of coexistence, have no room in their imagination or their will for the other. There are many signs of that, as we've seen recently. Some stories that I'd like to tell from our experience was living in a Palestinian neighborhood. We saw that it took 10 to 20 years for our Palestinian neighbors to get building permits to add on a room to their land, to their house that had been there for 50, 60, 80, 100 years. It took 10 years to get permit to add on one room. Or it took them 10 to 20 years just to build on their land that had been in their home under Ottoman rule, in their family, land that had been in their family for Ottoman rule. Very different than the Israeli side, where permits went through a traditional bureaucratic process and would be processed quite promptly. Also, the land that was used to build settlement roads, I think without exception, was taken from Palestinian farms and cities and villages. And that's just a fact that can be documented. That seems to be an us and them, too. Our land cannot be used for roads for settlements, but their road can. Their roads are where we put the water, but the water doesn't go to them. The water rights is another issue which I cannot speak to, except to know that our friends in Bethlehem are often without water during the summer months for weeks on end, while the settlements that ring Bethlehem, literally, always have water. So the water rights is a whole other issue which I cannot speak to, but shows us and them. And I've told this story before about this settler that made the statement to some people where I was standing that we were bulldozing a cistern, which was just to collect the rainwater in a field that belonged clearly, and everybody agreed, to a Palestinian farmer. And this settler said, even the rain that falls belongs to the Jews. And that's his theology, and it's an us and them, two different rights and two different visions of who gets to have what. And one final one, which was very hard for us to witness, was during 1976, I think, before we bombed Iraq, but we were planning to.
96.
Was it 96? What is
it?
Oh,
you said
96. Oh, 96. When the United States was planning to bomb Iraq, but didn't. But they were planning to. The Israelis were able to purchase gas masks internationally and also from the United States, but the Palestinians also asked for help with that, and no money, no gas masks, for fear of retaliation from Iraq of chemical weapons. Israelis were invited, and also we as foreigners were allowed to get them from our consulates, but Israelis were able to get them from their government. Families that had Israeli and Palestinian people married, the Palestinian family member was not welcome to a gas mask. It was, and the babies, if it was a certain, if the husband, I can't remember which parent was Jewish, then the child was not entitled to a gas mask either. That just shows an us and them. Shu could have been on the other foot, but this is the one story I have, was just of that. And that just showed that different sense of reckoning by who is who, by ethnicity. That to me supports that idea of this apartheid. Anyway, I just want to share my
experiences.
Thank you, Joe and Sue. You've said much of what I would probably have lifted up. And Joe, as usual, was extremely clear and systematic. Sue, insightful in her observations of daily life. In 1971, following graduation from St. Olaf, Susan and I went to Harvard Divinity School to visit. We stayed with Cynthia and Paul Hansen, and I think that they've been here at Holden many times. And I remember having my very first discussion about Israelis and Arabs on the living room floor at their house. We talked about what was happening, and I was amazed to hear of their support for the Palestinians. I couldn't believe it. I came from an area, I had moved around a lot, had a lot of Jewish friends, had celebrated in 1967 when Israel had reclaimed the old city of Jerusalem. And I was amazed that anybody would have views that ran counter to that. And then I went to divinity school at Yale, and most of my studies were in learning Hebrew and studying the Old Testament and trying to make linkages between Old Testament theology and Christian theology, and in a sense looking at the Old Testament as the source book, and seeing the New Testament as in a kind of deferential relationship to the Old Testament. Then we went through graduate school and all the hoops that you jump through to become a pastor. We eventually moved to Vienna, Austria after having served in Boston, Massachusetts. And I remember working hard to reach out and to meet a resurgent Jewish community in Vienna, in the Second District, an Orthodox community, and how wonderful that was, because in Vienna, the Jewish population was decimated. And how wonderful it was to see Jews, to see kosher shops reopening and a vibrant Jewish community beginning anew. Then we moved in 1998 to Jerusalem. We had visited once before in 1996, and that was my first encounter. I remember the conference organizer asking if there would be some participants who would be willing to ride a tour bus to Bethlehem. In those days, you could simply take a bus and go directly to Bethlehem. And the reason was not to go to the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem, but to pick up Mitri Raheb, the Lutheran pastor at Christmas Lutheran Church, because he did not have a permit to come to Jerusalem. And so he could ride with us in the bus, and the Israeli soldiers at the checkpoint would just assume we were all international tourists and just wave us through. And so just moving to Jerusalem and just walking the streets of Jerusalem, I love cities, all cities. I love both West and East Jerusalem. Just walking the streets and watching how people live, how people interact, it became clear to me that Palestinians were treated in a second-class way. Now, I don't have any kind of expertise or background in the struggle against apartheid in South Africa, but having talked to people in Palestine, internationals who lived and worked in South Africa during that period, they have made that connection, but they have always pointed out, you know, sometimes Palestinians say, well, it's much worse than it was ever in South Africa. And our friends have pointed out that it depends where you were in South Africa and when. And so it's not an easy, no simplistic answer is easily arrived at. I want to give just a very brief excursion here in why it is so difficult to grasp some of the challenges of this situation and to see both sides, the suffering of both sides. This is from the July 8th New York Times, the front section. Essentially, there are two articles, if you can ignore the advertisement on sex at the bottom left-hand corner. There are two articles. One article deals with the occupation of the West Bank, and it gives the figures. For instance, there are 8 metropolitan areas in the West Bank. 7 of them are occupied. That involves approximately 700,000 people. That means every few days, the curfew is lifted for a couple of hours and people can scramble about trying to find food and get back in time before the curfew comes down again. 1 million other Palestinians are affected because they can't go to work, they can't go to school, they can't go to hospitals. Think, do any of you have relatives that need kidney dialysis? Well, if you do, you know how important it is that access to the hospital is there, to the dialysis center. Imagine living in the West Bank where you cannot go, where you cannot go for your treatment. That is the way it is. People who need dialysis have died because they cannot get there. Mothers in labor have died at checkpoints because they cannot get to hospitals. This happens over and over. And it is a reality, and I invite you to come and just see. There are growing groups of checkpoint watchers, some sponsored by the World Council of Churches, that send accompaniers, that's their term, to come and observe what is happening at checkpoints, at various intersections between Israeli and Palestinians. Anyway, the second article deals with the rehabilitation of Israelis that have been blown apart by suicide bombs. And so, for instance, there's a picture of a beautiful young woman here. And then the larger picture to the right shows her today with her face horribly scarred as she tries to do a very simple thing, tries to paint a giraffe. And your heart breaks when you see these pictures. Both articles tell the truth. In fact, the larger article, it's about 2.5 times longer, mentions the number of, first of all, it mentions the number of Israelis wounded by suicide or other terroristic attacks as around 2,000. But it also mentions the number of Palestinians, 37,500. But you see the pictures, and the pictures are, those were an editorial decision to show those pictures, and I don't know that I disagree with the format, because I know there have been other times where pictures have been shown of Palestinians at checkpoints that are in desperate need of medical care and can't cross. But that's just one thing to be aware of when you read the paper, that there are editorial decisions that are made as to how the article is formatted, literally, in the paper. I think that's enough.
Thanks, Michael. Susan?
I would like to actually use the words of Jeff Helper, who is a professor of anthropology at Ben-Gurion University, an Israeli, very active, well, heads the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. And this came via the internet shortly before I left on Wednesday, July 3rd, and it is a copy of what he said to the European Parliament on June 20th of this year, a hearing on the EU-Israel bilateral relations. And he is really a prophetic voice, I think, for many of us. So I would just like to read, and he ends with a reference to apartheid, so stay with me. This is Jeff Helper's words. I would like to begin my presentation by talking about sides. There is a perception, indeed, an expectation, that Israelis and Palestinians will be on separate, conflicting, and irreconcilable sides of what is called the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. There is a committee of the European Parliament that liaisons with the Palestinian side, and another that liaisons with the Israeli side. I would like to declare at the outset that I do not locate myself on either of these sides. For me, as an Israeli Jew, sides mean something different altogether. I am on the side of Israelis and Palestinians who seek a just peace that addresses Palestinian rights of self-determination, as well as Israeli concerns of security and regional integration. I am on the side that stands for equality, human rights, democracy, peaceful coexistence, and regional economic development. To be sure, there is another side, those Israelis and Palestinians that advocate exclusivity, conflict, a win-lose mentality, and continued injustice and suffering. That is the way the sides divide, not Palestinian-Israeli. Then he goes on to give some examples, but just a couple of other areas. Neither Israel nor its pre-state Yishuv nor the Zionist movement as a whole has ever recognized the Palestinians as a distinct people with national or even individual rights and holding legitimate claims to the country. The issue of symmetry, which we've raised several times, the issue of symmetry or a fundamental lack of symmetry must be recognized at the outset. There are no two sides from the point of view of power, of the ability to resolve the conflict equitably, and even of responsibility. We often speak of two sides, each of which must, quote, stop the violence, or which is, quote, equally guilty of perpetuating the conflict. But this ignores the fundamental imbalance of the situation. One side, Israel, is an internationally recognized state with one of the most powerful military forces in the world, including 200 to 300 nuclear warheads, making it the world's fifth largest nuclear nation, and an economy more than 20 times larger than that of the Palestinians. And it is the occupier. The other side is a fragmented, stateless, impoverished, vulnerable, and traumatized people, 70% of which are refugees or displaced persons, possessing no sovereignty and only a lightly armed militia. And it is occupied or exiled. The Palestinians, moreover, are in a situation of resisting colonization, a right recognized in international law, which differentiates their use of violence as resistance to Israel's violence as repression, the latter a violation of the right of self-determination. While Palestinians must also be held accountable for their actions, including the use of terrorism, their situation is qualitatively different from that of the Israelis, whose use of state terror and systematic violations of human rights in making its occupation permanent involve a much greater degree of choice. He goes on then to list the various articles of the Fourth Geneva Convention which have been violated in the way that Israel has been an occupying power and the ways that it has made its occupation permanent. And I can read those later if people are interested, but they are very telling. And finally, at the end, he says, and he's speaking, of course, to an international group in the EU at that point, the occupation poses a bold challenge to the international community, whether to its elected representatives, as in this chamber, or to the civil society, as represented by the NGOs and faith-based organizations testifying before you today. In an era of global transparency, of mass media, instantaneous news coverage, and the internet, can a new Berlin Wall be built that locks millions of Palestinians behind massive fortifications, Israel's $100 million security fence? Decades after the end of colonialism and a decade after the end of South African apartheid, will the international community actually sit passively by while a new apartheid regime arises before our very eyes? And in a world in which the ideal of human rights has gained wide acceptance, could an entire people be imprisoned in dozens of tiny, impoverished islands, denied its fundamental rights of self-determination? Until we all act according to the ideals and rules we ourselves have created, the answer will remain blowing in the wind.
Thank you. Thanks, all four of you. All right, now we turn to you perhaps you don't have the same expertise on the situation, but many of you have opinions, learned opinions. Some have traveled. So this is your chance to engage and offer your own perspectives and ideas. I will say Holden prides itself on a tradition of lively conversation. So lively is great, and let's really try to keep it as conversation. A couple weeks ago, we had Rabbi Robert Marks here and also Esther Mann, and they also talked about the Middle East. And one of the parallels Esther drew was between the situation in the United States with Native Americans and that whole colonial history that we also share. Probably you've heard things you disagree with or want to speak to or resonate with or whatever, so let's open it up to all of you if you want to make comments or address questions or whatever. This is your opportunity for lively conversation. And just remember, we do all live here together, and we'll see each other at breakfast. And you can keep going to their sessions or whatever as well, but I hand it right there, Beth. Did you have your name?
Yeah, I'm Beth, and I went to South Africa year 2001 for 6 months, go to university. And I think it's an interesting parallel connection between Israeli occupation and apartheid. But I just wanted to bring some, I guess, of my own insight. I went to South Africa with the preconceived notions of black versus white. And as I was studying there, even though the apartheid has been over for almost 8 years, whatever, there's a lot of interracial conflict. I mean, we have to remember that there's Afrikaners and British people, and they're white, and yet, you know, they're not. I couldn't clump them together. At first, I thought I could, and you know, I've realized that they're very different cultural views. There's also Indians. South Africa is the second largest Indian population in the world outside of India. There's colors, there's then the indigenous people of Xhosa and Zulu and Basutu, and they have 11 national languages. So it's extremely diverse and extremely interconnected. And there's a lot of conflict between the blacks and the colors and the Indians and the whites and the British and the Afrikaners. And I just wanted to just clarify that appreciated, but I forget your name, but the article you read, that it's not just one side versus another. And the apartheid has ended, and there's still obviously racial conflict. But one thing about South Africa, which may provide hope for the Palestinian future, they provided a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which went and examined all of the war crimes during apartheid, and through a lot of healing and you know, a lot of controversial issues and forgiveness, they had this reconciliation between forgiving people for the crimes they've done and trying to be able to move on as a country. And they have a long ways to go, let me tell you, but you know, I think there is some hope, so thanks.
Others?
Well, I just wanted to ask a question, and maybe I'm out of date, but none of you mentioned what I think is the fact that all but Jordan and Egypt, and I think still the Palestinian Authority, have official state policy that calls for the destruction of Israel. Is that not true?
No, that isn't true.
Okay, what is the actual...
Do you remember when President Clinton went to Gaza in 1999, that was sort of a condition for continued aid to the Palestinians.
So the Palestinians no longer have that policy. What about...
And neither does Jordan, and neither does Egypt.
That's what I said.
Jordan
Other than Egypt and Jordan, all the surrounding countries, as well as other neighboring countries, do have policies calling for the destruction of state Israel. Is that not true? I mean, I just want to be... I want to clarify that. And the reason I ask that is that if we're going to put it all out on the table, we got to put it all out on the table. You know where my position is on this. I just think it's important to recognize that that's part of the equation. And we can't, and that is very different. Now, sure, there were other African countries that called for the destruction of, you know, the apartheid regime. I don't know that that's a parallel situation in terms of the economic and political and military resources of those neighboring countries, even with Israel's overwhelming superiority. So if we're going to paint the picture, I just want to make sure the Saudi
plan that we heard about and have been hearing about certainly involved the idea that these countries would recognize Israel's right to exist as part of the deal, for the peace. So
that's not going to...
It's not been accepted yet. I mean, we haven't gone that route yet, but
And those nations haven't.
And the other nations haven't said they're going to do that,
right.
No. But at least there's some efforts trying to change that. But yes, that does. It's certainly part of the picture that Israel has always felt, very much isolated, and they are.
Yeah, so, for instance, Israel prefers to be part of Europe. And it's never been accepted in the Middle East. And so it would like to be part of, in terms of the United Nations organization, as it would like to be part of the European Union.
Do you have a question?
No, okay. Other comments?
I was wondering what you would see as a viable solution to the conflict over there from your own perspective, your experience. What might work? What could we work for in the U.S. to help support peace over there? What could be done? Comments from
Do you have a preference, or do you?
I have a preference. All of you different perspectives. Yes.
I'll provide a bit of a response. The Oslo Accord was the momentum behind that was separation. And the people that I've spoken to, and I'm not a lawyer, but I understand that the Europeans, in talking with some of the European diplomats in Jerusalem, the Europeans had brought in constitutional lawyers to evaluate the Israeli constitution. And they felt that it had to be separateness. That they couldn't form a pluralistic state in the broad sense of the term as a function of the Constitution. And therefore, their diplomatic points of view were encouraging that separation to where there would be a Palestine formed and an Israel formed, rather than trying to bring about a solution of bringing them together. Now, whether that's true, I really don't know, but that's what I did. That's what I understood while we were there.
What were the points in the Constitution?
Well, that by definition, Israel is a predominantly Jewish state. And therefore, and they're looking for Israel as a haven for the Jewish people.
So I think, just to put it very simplistically, but I think appropriately, the question is, can Israel be both democratic, recognizing the Palestinians, the Druze, other ethnic groups within the larger Jewish population? Can it be democratic and Jewish at the same time? And that's going to be a fundamental challenge to the Israel nation.
I would like to just respond. There's basically three things that would probably possibly satisfy at least the Palestinians, and that is that if Israel were returned to the 1967 borders and be in the area that it was agreed to prior to that, that Jerusalem would be a shared capital for Israel and for the state of Palestine, whatever form that ended up taking, and that the refugees, the an acknowledgement, and this is really important in terms of like the truth and reconciliation issue, an acknowledgement that a wrong has been done to the Palestinian people in the process of the establishing of Israel, that they have suffered, that an acknowledgement on the part of Israel to this would go a long way, and then an agreement that the refugees have a right to return, the idea being that most of them would not do that, being established in other places, but would have some compensation. This is complicated. The refugee issue is a very complicated one in terms of how that would work out, but there are people who don't feel that that's an insurmountable one. But those three things, four things basically, including the acknowledgement by Israel that they've there has been a wrong that's been done to this people in the process of creating and establishing their state.
So you feel that's a possibility, that solution?
That solution?
It's been really thorny.
I don't know. I don't know if it's a possibility. I think it's the one that would make for a long-term security for both peoples. I don't know how possible right now it is.
I think there used to be stuff in the Resource Center about this whole effort for a shared Jerusalem, for example, that the ELCA and many different Christian faith communities are really working on as one thing, one part of what you said.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I don't know your name. What's your name?
Bonnie.
Okay.
What role do you see the U.S. playing in this, and what strategies, if any, are faith-based or any other groups coming up with to influence our role? Peace.
Well, I think that there are faith-based groups that are involved in, for instance, in Jerusalem. Some of you saw pictures of Sandra Olwine and Doug Dick. They're trying to make sure that people in the Christian community who go over to do a pilgrimage or to travel to what we commonly refer to as the Holy Land, that they see both sides of what's going on and not just one side. And I think that is an important part of educating the American public about what is going on. They refer to that as a living stones pilgrimage rather than focusing only on the dead stones, going to see the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, etc. So I think that's a very worthwhile undertaking. But I think that one thing that is really difficult about this, and I just have to say it as it relates to the larger picture historically, is that I do think that the problem here is it's going to be difficult to deal with it politically, but there's been a historic problem, and I don't think that anyone in the discipline of international relations has ever really investigated this, but I've talked to Sue about it. I think there needs to be a better understanding of what I would refer to as the residual of war, or the residual of violence, the leftover, the hangover residual of what has happened to the Jewish people over the centuries, and how that has resulted in their current feeling of a state of siege, and why they've done what they've done. Until every country can say that they are going to make sure that the Jews in their borders are not treated in a way that has resulted in them feeling like they need a safe haven, maybe this problem isn't going to be solvable. And I know that sounds a little bit, I mean, that's pie in the sky, but we've been talking here in the sessions about the need for, you know, diligently preventing religious nationalism. The Jewish people, and Rick, please correct me if you disagree with this, and I don't mean to single you out, but the Jewish people are going to tend to have, they're going to tend to be discriminated against for three reasons. Number one, their religion is not based, it's not an evangelical religion, it's based on blood lineage. So by definition, it's not going to grow substantially in the same way that Christianity and Islam did. Number two, their religious practices, at least for those of the Orthodox tradition, tend to mean that they're going to dress differently, they're going to have different dietary practices, they will be separate. And third, they tend to be very successful, business-wise, etc. As a result, they are going to tend to be scapegoated, discriminated against, encounter religiously bigoted jokes, etc., and they're going to be the subject of violence. I mean, in political science, there's maybe it's not a political science term, the concept of pogroms. The term pogrom was developed precisely because of the slaughtering of Jews throughout Europe over the centuries. Pogrom, P-O-G-R-O-M, I believe is how it's spelled.
Also ghetto.
The ghetto.
Ghetto was a section of Venice where the Jews lived in the up until they were pushed out during the Inquisition.
A section of where?
Of Venice.
Oh, many cities.
Venice.
The ghetto, the word ghetto.
It was also in Italy, there was a ghetto in Trastevere in Italy, I know. And but all I'm saying is that to some extent, over the centuries, you've got a residual of Jews being discriminated against and being slaughtered. And every country that was involved in that is culpable in the current behavior of Israel. And until we accept that, and we agree to make sure that the Jews in our communities are not treated that way, and it's going to take years before that residual of war, or whatever you want to call it, works itself out, and there's truth and reconciliation, and there's forgiveness and atonement and everything else, then you're at ground zero to be able to deal with the political problem. And that's why it's so difficult, it seems to me.
Except you don't have the luxury of letting another group of people befall that.
Right.
You know, oppression and denial of human rights in the meantime.
Right.
I mean, both have to be safeguarded.
I was just going to say one other thing. I was really struck in your pictures today. It looked like Bishop Munib Younan and a delegation went to visit Yasser Arafat to ask the suicide bombings and stuff. That's a faith-based initiative, but it's the local Christian community in the Middle East. I mean, that's another thing we can do is support faith groups in the Middle East, the small yet really important Christian population, if that's an agent of reconciliation, which it looked in the pictures like it was. Okay, let's see. Back there, Roxy.
What do we say then about the Jews that go to their settlements from the United States, they're American citizens? What do we say about those people? It seems to me like they're going there to spite. And they go there with fervor and as mission to put the Palestinians out. And I don't know what to think of that because,
well,
do we do something here that makes them want to go do that?
Oh, well, that's an interesting question. I think by and large, one has to recognize, though, that the people that go to the settlements are not ideologically bound. There are some who are, and some settlements that are like that. But by and large, a new immigrant to Israel who decides to live on a settlement in the West Bank or in East Jerusalem or surrounding Jerusalem, does so most of the time for the economic benefit. It's a much higher standard of living. It's a subsidized kind of housing. They're often very lovely places to live when you have a minimal income. So I think that's the most likely situation. Now the people that you're talking about are definitely a problem. I mean, I don't know if you can locate that in the U.S. treatment of Brooklyn Jews. I mean, I don't think so. I don't know. Maybe you can.
Okay. Let's see. Over. Okay. Yeah. Okay. The balcony. You don't have your lights on. Okay. A comment here. Okay. And then we'll get up here. Uh huh.
I listened to an NPR interview with a Israeli journalist that described the polarization between the Israelis and the Palestinians in terms of that the 10 or 20% of the hardened, warlike, hardened, inimical on each side are now in control, and that the middle peace-oriented folks on both Israeli and Palestinian sides are now have no ground to stand on, and that this has further weakened the possibility that was starting to grow under the Oslo Accords. And he was asked a number of very good questions and very thoughtfully answered about what might create those conditions again. And he was saying, well, it's gone so far, the security of the Israelis has been so severely impaired by the terrorism, not to mention the centuries of terror before. And trauma tends to create kind of a sense of constant threat. People who have post-traumatic stress disorder are hyper-vigilant. They are expecting threat when there is no threat. Their threat alarm system in their brain is overactivated, and so these folks are primed, and they are the survivors. They're the ones that didn't die and sort of Darwinianly selected to come to Israel as the survivors, the fighters, the succeeders, and the children of those, and the sabras that were the prickly cactus children of the desert that made it bloom. These are very tough and strong and children of traumatized people, and they now are surrounded by limbs flying on their streets. Whatever kind of oppression they're doing that is clearly wrong now is such an overreaction, but it's in that context. So the Israeli journalist was asked about this question, how might this be stopped? And his thought was that the settlements are such a key sticking point that is stabbing at the heart of any possible solution, East Jerusalem and right of return also, but the settlements are in their face. And that if the United States, in response to what the United States might do, were to pressure Israel, I mean to really pressure Israel, to say get out of the settlements, the Israelis fear that if they get out of the settlements that they then become a haven for terrorists, and indeed they may be. They are sort of at strategic places trying to protect their population centers. So if they leave the settlements, the Israelis are afraid that the Palestinians come back. The journalist from Israel was suggesting that American peacekeeping troops might be the only acceptable international peacekeeping troops, to the Israelis at least, who seem to hold all the cards, to come in to the settlements and to gradually build some trust, build some safety, separate the peoples. So this was a solution that, you know, is, I don't know if it's a pleasant one, but it sounds like something closer that might begin to de-escalate.
And that's also been a Palestinian request for almost 2 years now, to get international peacekeeping troops into the West Bank to separate Israelis and Palestinians. And probably the first and simplest statement is simply to stop the killing from both sides.
I think one of the most difficult things for us as North Americans in grappling with this as a public issue, especially in comparison with the South African situation, is that you mentioned local leaders who were perhaps agents of reconciliation, but there is no internationally credible voice of both resistance and peace. And Desmond Tutu, if you will, that we can hear. And in the absence of that, all we see are suicide bombers. So it's very difficult to reconcile all this, these issues, from North America. Your perspective is quite different, but the thing that moves public opinion, and public opinion, world opinion was very important with apartheid, is that there are those voices.
I'll just say that's one reason why we sang that song tonight. Dennis Friesen-Carver had a really interesting comment the other night. You know, what's the equivalent of the freedom songs that we started singing at Holden and in the world that had that message? And I think this song tonight was a really beautiful example of that in Arabic.
Can I respond to Tom's point just real quickly, which is where I was going to. There are, in fact, those voices, because I get letters through the internet, through my friends in Israel, both Palestinian and Israeli, who work with those groups. I mean, there's the Abraham Fund, there's other organizations with leadership who put those things out. We don't hear them here.
Right.
They don't have, I mean, Michael was saying, they're not getting printed in the New York Times, but those voices, in fact, are there. I mean, there are marches of 100,000 people with speeches and so forth, where people are speaking that voice of reconciliation, peace, both Palestinian and Israeli. We don't hear them here. And so, and I don't know, if, you know, is it a conspiracy, whatever. We're not, they are not being heard here. And it seems to me that one of the things that we can do in this country, that I'm trying to do, is we need to provide, you know, I've got my email list. I send those emails on to the, you know, 50 people that I know, and hopefully they're doing it also. And second, we need to find those organizations, and we need to start moving our philanthropy towards those organizations, and, you know, and the work that you guys are doing. We need to be giving these people funds so that they can be doing more of this kind of work. There is not a lot of money in the nonprofit funding world for those kinds of voices, because I know, because I'm looking for it for Africa, and it's just, there's not a lot of, the philanthropy world has not figured this one out yet. And that's an area that a policy in the third sector, in the nonprofit sector, that is absolutely essential. So anybody here who's involved in philanthropy work has got to really focus on where the peace building and reconciliation movement, which is nascent but it's starting to grow, needs resources and needs a voice, and it's not going to get it from government. Yeah. So we have, you know, we have to find a way of getting them resources.
Thank you. I'll just say on that one, the guy who's arriving Saturday to lead the Bible study, Fred Strickert, I've never met, but I know through his amazing email list, he's always passing out something. If you want to do that too, anybody wants to get on Fred's email, just tell him on a Saturday.
I think it would be helpful too if Rick had some and the Thomases and others to share ways that people can get access to information like Mitri's. Email,
Go
to Mitri's page and get that. You can connect to that from the ELCA website. You can get on the Ann Hampton list, whatever it's officially called, and get weekly updates from the ecumenical community. You could be online with Church World Service, which also has a special page that gives regular updates from people kind of in the field. And even if you just had those three, direct voices from Palestinian congregations in Bethlehem, from the ecumenical list and from Church World Service, you know, you begin to have different access points and then, you know, network with folks like Rikus.
And what about Holden's website, Barbara? Why can't Holden's website?
Make a list.
That's true. Holden. Tom Witt. Tom Witt is the webmaster. All right, Stacey, would you be willing to come down here and write some of those up here, then you know this by heart?
Just put the ELCA website
Okay, it's www.elca.org. Okay.
And then it says resources, and then you can connect directly to the, what's it called?
Now, let me just say, I'm sure you all know, we don't have any web access at Holden, and Holden's website isn't accessible from Holden either, but there is a Holden website out there. But we can't.
It's a good thing.
Yes. Okay, go ahead.
The analog for insolvable problems that have been resolved for me in this case is partially Desmond Tutu in South Africa, but more particularly in our generation, what Gorbachev did completely changed the paradigm of the nation and changed the course of history. And yes, you need the underlying support of the groundswell of the little people, you might say, on the street, which we're talking about here, but it's the leadership that has the vision to make those changes, that make those kinds of dramatic quantum leaps, you might say. And my question is, from your experience in the Middle East, is there any leadership developing of that level?
No. Almost every day we meet Palestinians that have great insight, creativity, and learning. Their voices are not yet the persuasive voices in the so-called Palestinian street, which I think is governed more by religious and political militancy than the voice of desire for reconciliation.
And I think among the Palestinians, you also have the issue of in the Arab world, and for the Palestinians, in this case, they're learning about democracy and how you bring an elected leader into the forefront, and that's not really working really well yet for them. In Israel, you have tremendously fragmented political parties. There's like 33 different political parties that are represented in the Knesset. I mean, so you're always cobbling together some kind of a coalition government that is likely to be toppled at any moment, you know. So it's not a monolithic situation in either case, and the leadership, the more moderate and more reasonable to Western kind of thinking people in the Palestinian sector are not getting a lot of good press at the moment in among Palestinians. I mean, when they do speak out, which they have been, they tend to be discounted or branded as
collaborators.
If you are someone interested in conversation with Israel about this, you might be a collaborator.
Okay, we have about 5 minutes left. I see one hand. Anybody who hasn't had a chance to say something who wants to, feel free. There are books in the bookstore that the Thomases and Bach likes ordered, two by Mitri Rahib. He's a Lutheran leader anyway, so check out those resources. Lauren.
Well, I'd just like to pass on Rabbi Robert Marx's comment. He said the best thing that we could do as Americans is pressure our own politicians to cut off what he said was the $1.9 billion aid to our own arms industry, which he says is the supplier of arms. He says we've got to quit cut off the arms. That was his number one thing that we can do.
I'm a little surprised because Israel has such a thriving arms industry, and I would assume that they'll just
transfer to their themselves.
Yeah.
Others? Thank you.
Well, you know, your original question, dealing with the parallelism of apartheid, whether there was or not, in my opinion, there isn't much. And I think apartheid resolved by a lot of pressure, United Nations pressure, American pressure, and pressure from the world. But oversimplified, it was primarily an economic system. And we're just as guilty in dealing with migrants today as apartheid was in our own country. And we don't get excited about that.
Yeah.
But, you know, Israel and Palestine, we can go back to Father Abraham and start looking at the separations that have occurred over the centuries. And I'm not so sure that it's the nationalism that's just the problem as much as maybe individuals who want their own entity. I mean, the expansionism of Israel right now is just unacceptable, and they're getting away with it. And they're doing it so that they can claim these lands forever, just stealing it from the Palestinians. Well, we gave it to them from the Palestinians to start with, you know? Somehow, a democracy isn't gonna work, the parliament system isn't gonna work. If they're gonna live together, it's gonna take something else in terms of a controlling factor for a while until culture changes, and that takes a tremendous amount of time. It's not an overnight solution.
Thank you. Well, let's ask our panelists, do you have any final remarks you wanna make here before we wrap it up?
I would like to make one comment just in terms of the kind of freedoms that Americans are used to having and treasuring. And when I think about the situation for people in the Palestinian areas, the freedom of movement and freedom of mobility is just non-existent. And for us as Americans to be able to move freely is just a given. I mean, we just expect that. And the difference between that expectation and the reality that that those people live under, I think, is what for me makes the kind of parallel to apartheid the strongest, that, that you have that sort of constricted life that's enforced on you.
Well, I would just like to say that, urge us to remember the Palestinian Christians especially, that they are part of the body of Christ, that they are suffering, and that we remember their suffering, and also lift them up as a voice of hope in the Middle East, in Israel and Palestine, that they can function as a mustard seed. I think more than any other group in that area of the world, they can embody, they have the potential to embody forgiveness. And I think that is one of the key characteristics of Christian life and practice, the ability to forgive. And that's why they are so important, that they are there, not so that we can feel good when we make a pilgrimage and we not only visit the Church of the Holy Sepulchre and meet a Palestinian shopkeeper and talk to Palestinians, but because they are important right there. They are a very, I'm sure that Joe's been talking about ecological niches here in Bolden and the Cascades. They are an ecological niche that is desperately needed in that dry and parched land for justice. Without the Palestinian Christian, I think it's going to be ever so more difficult to establish a just and peaceful society or societies there. And then lastly, I think it's very clear, and we don't know Palestinians that support suicide bombings, but we know that somewhere between 70% and 90% do. So that probably shows you that our entree is also reduced. And one of the things that we try to urge those that we come into conversation with is that it's absolutely inconceivable that Israel will ever cave into suicide bombers. That will never happen in a million years. And unfortunately, I think perhaps Palestinians, Hamas, and other organizations maybe grasped at that moral failure from looking at actions that are fundamentally immoral and flawed from Israel's decision to unilaterally withdraw from Lebanon. And they thought that, some people say, that's really when the Intifada began. And so Hamas and other organizations thought they could put the squeeze on Israel. And by the same token, Palestinians are never, ever going to give up the dream of their own land. That will never happen. And so it seems to me that the first thing that has to happen is somehow these two people locked into a dance of death that is completely nightmarish and without any quality of moral imagination have to be pulled apart. And I think the United States is the one force in the world that can do that. If we can change the political processes here to help our Congress people and policymakers see that there is a call, a cry for justice within the Palestinian reality that has to be heeded in order that Israel can have security and justice.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you, our